Whether it's pig pickin' cake, pecan pie, or something more unusual like baked shad, we all have family recipes handed down from generation to generation. Some ingredients are safeguarded and only known by a few, but for those more willing to share their secrets, the North Carolina Museum of History Associates is asking residents from the mountains to the coast to send in their unique family recipes for a soon-to-be-published statewide cookbook. I spoke with co-chairman Charles Silver about the project and how they're trying to document the culinary landscape of the Tar Heel State by sharing personal stories and traditions behind treasured recipes.
We're looking for old family recipes that have a story. We're also looking for new, more modern recipes because people have changed the way they cook and entertain over the last 200 years.
So where exactly did you get this idea from? You know that the recipes and the food that we eat can sort of paint a picture of what it looks like to live and eat in eastern North Carolina.
Well, it's really easy. Entertaining and food have been a way of life in North Carolina, everywhere. People gather around the meal table to talk and enjoy each other. We've divided the state into eight regions, one being the Northeast and another being the South Coastal region. And we're looking for recipes that use the produce or the game of those areas. And we have in each section, there'll be a little story about that part of the state and a menu for typical ways people would have eaten in the 1700s, 1800s, and then a modern menu that people could use today and the recipes that back those up.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you're collecting recipes from the different regions of the state. How does food differ from, say, the Piedmont region and here in eastern North Carolina?
Mostly it's ethnic differences. The Moravians, for example, who settled around Winston-Salem, have very different ways of cooking than the English who settled in northeastern North Carolina. There's a big Jewish population in Wilmington who settled there very early on, and they have different styles of cooking. And of course, we've got African-American cooking that's really different from some of the English and German and Scots-Irish that settled. So it's mostly ethnic differences. But there are different products and produce, too. Blueberries, for instance, southeastern North Carolina, apples in the mountains and foothills. Depending on what grew and what was produced there, you have different recipes and different types of breads, different types of desserts, that kind of thing.
How many submissions have you had so far?
We're well over 100 recipes that have been submitted. We'd like to have 300 or 400 to choose from. The more recipes we get, the better. We'd love to have anybody's recipe if they have a little family story or anything that they use on a regular basis that they think is fun and easy to do.
So maybe you could give me an example of a recipe that has come in that kind of stuck out to you or that was really interesting.
A really interesting one. The Moravians have some very different ways of doing chicken stew. There are a lot of different ways that people have done that. Chicken and dumplings. My grandmother called it chicken slick. The Moravians use a very different way of cooking it with very little but chicken. Not as many vegetables as we typically would see in that. So chicken stew, chicken pot pie, those kinds of recipes. There have been some really, really different ones from different places across the state. I thought that was fascinating that we would have the same kind of recipe, but all different variations of it.
So the deadline for submitting a recipe for the statewide cookbook was August 1st, and as I understand it, that's been extended until September 1st. How can folks submit their family recipes?
They can contact the North Carolina Museum of History Associates. You can either submit online or you can copy a recipe form, or you can call and talk to someone and quote it to them. So there are a lot of different ways we could do it.
Okay, and so out of the hundreds of entries that you receive, how do you select the recipe that will go into the final product, the cookbook?
We have a recipe testing committee, 22 people who have history in the restaurant business or in the food business, occasionally someone will have a recipe and there's one step in there that they leave out because they know it so well, they just don't think of it. And we want to be sure that we test them all to be sure that every step is in there so that it'll work when people use it. They have a really good time when they sit around and cook and test these.
Can I nominate myself to be in the recipe tasting committee?
Everybody wants to be on that committee.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jared.
Proceeds from the sale of the cookbook will go to support the North Carolina Museum of History. Silver says that they're still looking for sponsors like the Blueberry Association and Sweet Potato Council to help defray costs. For more information on how you can submit a recipe, go to publicradioeast.org. The theater group Magnolia Art Center is bringing A Raisin in the Sun to Eastern North Carolina. The play, set in the 1950s, focuses on an African-American family living in Chicago that suddenly acquires a large sum of money and purchases a home in a white neighborhood. Lee Jenkins spoke with members of the cast and crew and has this sneak peek of the production, which begins its run in Greenville next week.
What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore, and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
So goes Danny Glover's rendition of one of the most famous poems in African-American culture, Langston Hughes' A Dream Deferred. And from that poem comes the title of one of the most famous plays of that same culture, Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun. Soon, Raisin will open right here in Eastern North Carolina, thanks to Greenville's Magnolia Performing Arts Center.
Mama, there ain't no color people living in Claiborne Park.
Well, there's going to be some now.
So, that's the peace and comfort you went out and bought for us today.
According to director Janice Schreiber, the play focuses on the lives of a black Chicago family after they receive $10,000 from their deceased father's insurance, and the effect that money has on their ambitions and dreams. Keep in mind, this is the early 1950s, and that kind of money would be worth around $70,000 today.
This family is looking for their place in this world, and they struggle, really, to get there, and it really happens to the majority of the characters in the play.
But there's more to it than just the story of this family.
There is so much going on, and it's just not their survival. It has many controversial issues that are discussed, whether it be a woman who's trying to make a decision about whether or not she wants to have her child. It also brings up religious issues.
No, I don't want no coffee. I don't want nothing hot to drink. Why are you always trying to give me something to eat?
What else can I give you, Walter Lee Younger?
Jamal Johnson, who plays the leading role of Walter, says the play touched a personal chord for him.
Any role that you take on, if you're going to do it well, you're going to try to take on some aspect of that character. Part of his good aspect, I mean, he looks at his family and he wants better for his family.
This is the largest role Jamal has played out of all the 30-some productions he's been in, and it is easily one of the most demanding and powerful parts he has ever played.
It's a lot. I spend most of my time, even outside of rehearsal, studying lines, making sure that I know lines himself, most, I guess, emotional range of a character I've ever had.
My, them steps getting longer and longer.
Veteran actress Joanne Williams, who plays the lead role of Lena Mama Younger, the head of the household, agrees. These are demanding roles, and the play's status as a classic only reinforces the notion.
She's a very multi-dimensional character, and because Raisin in the Sun is also an iconic play in itself, if I could try to kind of draw a comparison, I would say that it's sort of like a Tennessee Williams play where everybody wants to play Blanche in Streetcar. It's like a Plum kind of role, but you have to be a certain age in order to do it.
But the cast of this production aren't all seasoned actors. For some, this is their first drama, or even their first time on stage.
There ain't so much between us, Walter. Not when you come to me and try to talk to me. Try to be with me a little, even.
Amy Staton, for instance, has never been in a play before, and in this show, she's taken on the principal role of the submissive but protective wife of Walter Lee Younger, Ruth.
I find it an honor to be able to work with people that have acting experience. I learn a lot.
It can be difficult, however, like for Collis Moore, who's taken on the role of the play's only white character, Carl Linder.
My character is trying to keep the African-American family in the play from moving into a white neighborhood. Some of the things he says are pretty harsh. He says them subtly, but he's trying to force them out. It's not something I'm really familiar with. I've been trying to, you know, study some history and different things about how things were back in the 50s and 60s.
While these varying degrees of experience can make the already tedious process of directing a play that much more difficult, director Janice Schreiber welcomes the opportunity.
It is wonderful, actually, when you have somebody who has done a lot of theater who can, and very beautifully, not in a way that is condescending to somebody who doesn't have the experience, but to really be sort of a guiding force with somebody who's been around for a while and done a few shows. Still, there's always something new to be learned about the process.
For a director, that process includes quite a bit of research.
Essentially, I as a director become my own dramaturge. A dramaturge is a person who does the research, and they work side by side with the director. That's kind of a very big piece of it, and takes and demands a lot, and demands you to do it a few months in advance, so you go in as a knowledgeable individual.
Then there's coordinating all of the actors and set pieces. And in a very prop-heavy and activity-heavy play like Raisin, that can become quite a hassle, like when stocking the 1950s apartment's kitchen.
I am very meticulous about trying to be as close to the time period as possible, which is in the early 50s. And so getting the kitchen was a hard thing to do, and a lot of the various pieces are quite expensive. So luckily, through my connections at East Carolina University's Department of Theater and Dance, I was able to get those pieces that I needed.
The play will open on the evening of August 2nd at 7:30 and will run for 2 weekends. There will also be a special benefit performance for the historic 3rd Street School on the 1st. I'm Lee Jenkins.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Vidant Health, now offering the Leksell Gamma Knife Perfection, helping doctors treat lesions and tumors of the brain and upper spine. Vidant Health, information online at vidanthealth.com/gamma. A recent book by a Greensboro author uses a senseless tragedy to explore how a community is knit and how it can become undone. George Olson has more.
Valerie Neiman uses her past work experience to provide the impetus for events in her new novel of fiction, Blood Clay.
As a newspaper reporter for many, many, many years, I've seen people react very differently. Some people are heroic and had no idea they could do it, and other people fail, and people always second guess. You'd like to go back and see, what if? Could I do this? Should I have done something different?
In the opening pages of Blood Clay, a young girl is attacked and killed by a pack of dogs, an attack that is witnessed by a school teacher in the fictional North Carolina town of Taborville, and whose efforts to stop the attack are questioned by that town's residents. But the book isn't so much about trying to find justice for a life that is lost, but about how the town reacts, specifically toward Tracy Gaines, the school teacher who comes under fire when her efforts to stop the attack are deemed insufficient.
I think each of those elements has its own place in the book. I was also really concerned with the idea of loving a place, of becoming part of a place. So I'm very much concerned with how people become part of a community, especially a rural community where we really rely upon each other. And what if, in falling in love with a place, that love was denied?
The town's acceptance of Tracy, tenuous at best as a newcomer to the town following her move from Ohio following the dissolution of her marriage, comes undone as people see her efforts to help the girl as feeble and her pointing out the owner of two of the dogs in the attack as an effort not toward justice but toward shifting the blame. The town's coolness toward her, and Tracy's reaction to it, are on display when Tracy lunches with Dave, a fellow teacher and longtime resident of the town.
He saw her raise her hand, open her mouth as if to speak, and he turned to see Marion Eddy and her mother. Marion, who ran the Quick Mart not far from the school, nodded and said good evening to him as she passed, steadying her mother's uneven steps, but it was clear that she wasn't acknowledging Tracy. Dave waited for Marion to turn back, to slap her forehead and say how she was just getting senile, just didn't recognize Miss Tracy sitting there. But Marion kept walking, and he couldn't make up a reason that he could get his mouth around. Short and sweet, he was ashamed. "I always believed that Southerners were friendly," she said at last. "People in Ohio, they're just cold. I came down here and everyone waved at me. I was driving through the country and people waved. I thought at first they mistook me for someone, but then I realized they just saw another human being. People up north look through you most of the time." Dave listened as if he were juggling china, as if a moment's inattention would let everything crash. "It just takes time to get to know people's way," he said. "Superficial. Smiles that don't mean anything." She didn't even sound upset, just resigned, as though this was the culmination of all that she'd come to expect.
Tracy's story, to some degree, is Valerie Neiman's story. Neiman was born and raised in New York, living there for 20 years before spending 25 years in West Virginia, where she divorced and moved to North Carolina. Unlike Tracy, though, Neiman sees the simple act of waving at a stranger not as two-faced, but as a societal good.
I think that the idea of courtesy and openness is important for society to function well, and I think that North Carolinians are the kindest and most open people I've ever known. But for someone who is suspicious, as Tracy now is, I think that they see it as solely a cover-up or manipulative. And so she's been jaundiced by what's happened in the wake of the tragedy. And now that's the way she looks at what she had viewed as wonderful, people waving. And that's something that happened when I moved here, that, you know, people would wave at me, and I didn't really understand that. So I'm drawing that out of my own experience. But unlike Tracy, I do feel that North Carolinians are the sweetest people I've ever been around, and that the openness and willingness to share is something that I've responded to.
While Neiman's lead character belies her own feeling about her adopted home state, there's also a similar conflict when looking at certain North Carolina traditions, particularly tobacco, which Neiman writes about in a heartfelt manner while acknowledging at different points in the book the ravages it can leave behind.
Dave loved the life cycle of tobacco, the culture that surrounded it, even if the plant made him sick and its final product was so devastating. People from outside tobacco country didn't understand that affection for the crop. They were used to wheat or corn, seeded and harvested, but not tended with that kind of intimacy. Tobacco was hand-raised from start to finish, from seeds planted in the greenhouse to the tender young plants set into the furrows from the back of a tractor, from weeding and priming and topping and pulling and racking and curing, all by hand. Even the enemies of tobacco seemed personal, farmers complaining bitterly of blue mold as though it had singled out their fields. It was a good part of life to see the fields flourish in the summer sun and then to follow tractors and wagons down the two-lane roads with green leaf gathered in the old way across the sticks on its way to propane-driven curing barns, while old log barns decayed picturesquely under morning glory and kudzu. Finally, the cured leaf tied up in burlap like giant hobo bindles and carried off to warehouses and auction. I think that a lot of what I write deals with the end of things, the end of a way of life in the novels that I've written and many of the stories. When I came to North Carolina, it was at the end of that kind of way of living, at least in small acreages. I know that the tobacco's become more mechanized, but you could still see when I first came here people out in the fields doing things by hand. And it really is a beautiful crop, seeing it grow and seeing it come up and the flowers when they are allowed to flower. And the whole tradition of it, the handling of it, and the beauty of the colors of the cured leaf, it was really attractive to me, just visually and as a sensory experience.
Despite that respect of tradition, Neiman also freely writes of the sickness that tobacco workers get handling the leaves, as well as the debilitating health effects suffered by users of the final product. She doesn't present a final judgment on the product, much as she doesn't present a final judgment on her lead character's situations. Justice is not necessarily served, and tattered relationships are not necessarily repaired.
I think that we've gotten accustomed to tidy endings in television and in movies where everything is sort of wrapped up by the end. Everyone's at peace, bad guy is hauled away in handcuffs, and and the community is restored. But maybe because I was a newspaper reporter, I thought that really didn't happen. The story goes on. People go on. You live your life. You keep going. And it's one darn thing after another. And so for these characters at the end of the book, there's some partial resolution. Something is finished at that point, but then other things are opened up, and they are going to go on with their lives. I have that sense of them going on, but they're not, they don't sort of go back into the box at the end of the book and everything's finished and that's the end of it. And I think that's much more reflective of real life.
Blood Clay by Greensboro author Valerie Neiman is published by Press 53. I'm George Olson.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Okay, I'll admit it. This is not my most favorite time for the garden. It's miserably hot outside, no matter what time of day, morning or evening it is. What a perfect time to talk about a gloomy scale. That's right, gloomy scale. This is a scale, hard scale type insect, found mostly on maple trees, particularly the soft maples, such as box elder, red maple, and silver maple. Gloomy scale can also be found on grapes, native hollies, mulberries, and sweet gum. Do you have a maple that's just not very healthy? Are small twigs starting to die back? Look closely. Does the bark look lumpy and bumpy and grainy? Well, take your finger and rub hard against that bark, maybe a little knife. Guess what? That's probably not the bark after all, but thousands of gloomy scale insects. Underneath each of those scales is a female gloomy scale with a long, piercing, sucking mouth part. The gloomy scale damages the tree both by its direct feeding and because of the impact of the saliva that it injects while it's feeding. Right now, you're seeing the overwintered gloomy scale females from last year, but development of new gloomy scale resumes and first crawlers come out in May. What are crawlers? Well, those are the young gloomy scale that hatch out from under the old scales of the female and crawl to find a new spot on the bark if there's not a gloomy scale on every centimeter already, where they can establish and begin feeding themselves. It's at this crawler stage, usually in April and May, when you can actually control the gloomy scale with horticulture oils. By this time of year, even this year's crawlers have covered themselves with a nice hard shell. Males, well, they'll emerge in August and September to mate with the new females. There's only one generation of gloomy scale a year here in North Carolina. It's interesting. The males that are going to be coming out soon, well, earlier in the season, right after they were crawlers, they also molted into legless scales. But come July and August, they molt again into prepupae and pupal stages in which the legs and wings again develop. Isn't that fascinating? Gloomy scale can get so thick on maple trees that you would swear it's the actual bark you're looking at, because every inch of the tree is covered, sometimes three layers deep in gloomy scale. What to do if you have an unhealthy maple and you check and see that, in fact, you do have gloomy scale? The most effective treatment for gloomy scale is horticulture oil applied in the spring when the crawlers are out. Generally, you're going to want two or maybe three applications, 10 to 14 days apart, in order to catch all the newly hatching crawlers. Read the label very carefully on your horticulture oil and follow those directions. If a tree is too large, well, the best thing to do is try and improve the growing condition of the tree. Do a soil test and adjust the pH as needed. Fertilize lightly. Maybe get rid of grass that's directly underneath the tree. Anything to enhance the tree's vitality without stimulating excessive growth. In other words, don't just put a whole bunch of high nitrogen fertilizer. If you get the tree healthier, it'll be less susceptible to the scale, and the scale will not reproduce as prolifically. And then native parasites and predators will take care of some of the scale as well. But if the tree is small enough where you can spray with horticulture oil, that's what you need to do. Go out and identify the scale now. Start getting the tree as healthy as you can. And then next spring, get a magnifying glass and watch for those teeny tiny microscopic crawlers. When they're out, start applying the horticulture oil. You might even want to try pressure washing scale encrusted bark. But be careful. You don't want to pressure wash too hard and damage the actual bark of the tree. So it's a gloomy time in the garden. It's hot and it's buggy and things aren't producing very well. A perfect time to go look for gloomy scale on your maple or other related trees. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.